Veranstaltung haben wir in der Gründungsphase heftig gestritten. Jede Entscheidung für einen bestimmten Namen ist eine Entscheidung gegen andere gute Möglichkeiten. Aber schließlich haben wir dann so optiert, wie wir es getan haben. Wir haben einen Philosophen gewählt, weil das, was man Geisteswissenschaften bzw. Humanities nennt, in der Philosophie seine höchste Verdichtung findet. Wir haben diesen Philosophen gewählt, weil er an der damaligen Berliner Universität gelehrt hat, aus deren Tradition auch die FU hervorgegangen ist. Und wir haben ihn des Weiteren gewählt, weil der zentrale Wert seiner Philosophie, die Freiheit, programmatisch im Namen dieser Universität figuriert, die ihre Existenz einer Phase der Berliner Geschichte verdankt, in der an anderen Orten die Freiheit des Denkens nicht gegeben hat. Dies Letztere ist seit 1990 Vergangenheit. Aktualität hat weiterhin im Osten wie im Westen dieser Stadt den Wert eines offenen, von politischer Bevormundung freien akademischen Diskurses. Man könnte, wenn es darum geht, kurz zu begründen, warum man Judith Butler einlädt, eine solche Hegel-Lecture zu halten, es damit bewenden lassen zu sagen, dass sie schlicht eine gewisse Evidenz hat. Wer in der heutigen intellektuellen Welt stünde mit Werk und Person so empathisch ein für Freiheit und Befreiung wie unser Gast? Aber der Connect ist noch ungleich enger als auf diesem Niveau allgemeiner Konzepte ersichtlich. Judith Butler hat in Yale Philosophie studiert, ist dann im Jahr 1978-79 nach Heidelberg gegangen, um bei Hans-Georg Gadamer zu hören, und sie hat nach ihrer Rückkehr in die Stadt mit einer Arbeit promoviert, die den Titel trägt Subject of Desire, Hegelian Reflections in 20th Century France. In dieser Arbeit hat sie untersucht, wie die großen französischen Denker des 20. Jahrhunderts Hegels Freiheitsbegriff weitergedacht haben, und sie hat dann in ihrem eigenen Werk jene in Kontinuität, teils aber auch in polemischer Auseinandersetzung mit Hegel stehenden Denker ihrerseits weitergedacht und dabei gerade, was das Konzept Freiheit angeht, Fragen aufgeworfen, die Hegel zu seiner Zeit schwerlich auch nur hätte erahnen können. Im Jahr 1991 wurde Judith Butler zum Full Professor am Humanities Center von Johns Hopkins berufen. Schon 1993 wechselte sie nach Berkeley, wo sie seit dem Jahr 1998 Maxim Elliott Professor of Rhetoric and Comparative Literature ist und von dort aus eine Wirkung entfaltet in ihrem eigenen Land und weltweit, deren Dimension man angesichts dieses überfüllten Hörsaals und der gleichfalls überfüllten hier weiteren Hörsäle hier im Henry Ford Hall die Veranstaltung übertragen wird, nicht mehr charakterisieren. Judith Butler wird heute Abend nicht über Gender sprechen. Sie hat die sehr wörtlich gemeinte Freiheit, die mit unserem Konzept der Hegel-Lecture verbunden ist, der Gast wählt den Fokus seines Vortrags selbst ohne Konsultation mit uns, genutzt, um sich der Festlegung auf die Frage Gender zu entziehen und klarzumachen, dass es aus ihrer Sicht außer dem Geschlechterverhältnis noch weitere zentrale, ja vitale Fragen gibt, die in einem freien Gemeinwesen diskutiert werden. Ich vermute aber fast, dass die Problematik Gender, so wie sie in ihren berühmten, kanonisch gewordenen Bänden Gender Charter 1990, Bodies That Matter 1993, Undoing Gender 2004 entwickelt hat, durchaus auch am Horizont ihrer heutigen Ausführungen aufschauen wird. Das Revolutionäre über alle anderen Theoretikerinnen und Theoretiker hinausgreifende Implikat dieser Bücher ist es, die Geschichte der Freiheit und der Befreiung bis zu dem Punkt weiterzudenken, an dem deutlich wird, dass wir zwar unvermeidlicherweise einen bestimmten materiellen Körper haben, aber für uns als Menschen im Verhältnis zu uns selbst, zu den anderen und im Verhältnis der anderen zu uns ist dieser Körper immer ein Phänomen des Bewusstseins. Er ist das, was wir uns vorstellen, als etwa weiblich oder als männlich. Was wir uns aber vorstellen, ändert sich, so hätte vielleicht Hegel formuliert, beziehungsweise wir können es ändern, wenn wir wollen. So reformuliert Judith Butler diese Einsicht oder dieses Postulat. Wir können, wenn wir dies wollen, den Begrenzungen der Materialität unserer Körper, in die wir ungefragt hineingeboren werden, entkommen, sie hinter uns lassen. Das ist die große Verheißung, das Versprechen, das ihrer philosophischen Reflexion zugrunde liegt. Diese Vereinigung von dezidiertem philosophischen Idealismus und Aktivismus, den Gedanken durch eigenes Tun, durch Performance, wie sie sagen, die Dinge ändern zu können, vielleicht das Beste, das ihr Heimatland die USA der Welt gegeben hat. Und sie treten heute hier auf in einem historischen Moment, in dem ihr Land nach einer sehr schwierigen Phase wieder mit eben jenem Versprechen Vaters der Freiheit und der unbegrenzten Möglichkeiten die Weltagenda intellektuell und auch emotional erobert hat. Mit der Wahl eines Präsidenten, dessen in der Materialität des Körpers ersichtliche ethnische Zugehörigkeit es noch vor 50 Jahren, wie er selbst sagt, ausgeschlossen hätte, auch nur in einem Fastfood-Restaurant der Stadt Wien zu werden, in der er vor 2 Wochen in durchaus imperialer Inszenierung zum mächtigsten Menschen auf diesem Erdball proklamiert. Herkunft, sei es als Geschlecht, sei es als ethnische Zugehörigkeit, ist in gewisser Hinsicht eine Gegebenheit, zweifelsohne. Aber wir als Bewusstseinswesen, als Menschen können uns aus diesem Gefängnis des scheinbar naturhaft Determinierten lösen, wenn wir diese Befreiung handelnd vollziehen. Dies bringt natürlich eine Frage ins Spiel, die untrennbar mit der Freiheitsproblematik verknüpft ist. Was führt uns dazu, uns im Unterschied zu unseren genetisch sehr engen Verwandten, den höheren Tieren, nicht mit der Wiederholung dessen zufrieden zu geben, was unzählige Generationen vor uns getan haben? Und was führt uns dazu, selbst die Schemata der von uns errichteten zweiten Natur, der Kultur, immer wieder in Frage zu stellen und oft auch umzustürzen? Und wo hat recht eigentlich die Freiheit ihren Sitz, wenn doch unser Bewusstsein unverbrüchlich gebunden ist an Schemata, die wir, wie Aristoteles sagt, durch Nachahmung, durch Mimesis gelernt haben, an den Code der Sprache und an die kulturellen Regeln und Konventionen? Judith Butler stellt sich dieser selbstkritischen Frage, die letztlich die uralte philosophische Frage ist, was ist das Spezifische des Menschlichen? Sie stellt sich dieser Frage offensiv in ihrem letzt erschienenen größeren Buch, Giving an Account of Oneself 2005, bis zu dem Punkt auch zu erwägen, dass der Ausbruch aus vorgängigen Ordnungen immer nur sehr partiell möglich sein könnte. Dieser letzte Gedanke ist radikal in Wurzeln. Er geht um die Wurzeln des Phänomens, er tangiert die Basis von Ethik. Es ist nur konsequent, dass eine Denkerin, die eine so verstandene Radikalität nicht scheut, sich dann in ihrer Reflexion auf dem Phänomen zuwendet, dass die Möglichkeit von Ethik und Moralphilosophie überhaupt in Frage stellt, dem Phänomen des Krieges. Friends of War ist der Titel des heutigen Vortrags. Sie, liebe Judith Butler, halten diesen Vortrag in der Metropole der westlichen Welt in ihrer Geschichte wie keine andere von dem gezeichnet ist, was Krieg bedeutet. Die meisten hier Versammelten kennen den letzten großen Krieg in dieser Weltgegend nur noch aus Erzählungen. Aber was Krieg ist, erlebt man in dieser Stadt nicht nur narrativ vermittelt. Als ich zum ersten Mal in meinem Leben wiederkam, 1992, damals noch als Tourist, hatte ich, was die meisten Touristen bis heute tun, ich fuhr hinauf auf den Fernsehturm am Alexanderplatz, in meinem Kopf, in meinem Gedächtnis den Blick, den ich während meiner Pariser Zeit so oft genossen hatte, hinab vom Eiffelturm ins Tal der Seine. Welch ein Unterschied, welch ein erschütternder Unterschied. Vor mir lag kein wie organisch gewachsenes, wohl komponiertes Ganzes, sondern ein bis heute von den Folgen Krieg, die zerrissene Stadtkörper, mühsam geflickt mit der Prothetik der Plattenbauten, Zerstörung, selbst in einer modernistischen Ästhetik des Hässlichen nicht offen. Ich habe mich diesem Anblick nie wieder ausgesetzt. Wer das heute im Jahr 2009 tut, sieht dann etwas in der Mitte Berlins, das ich damals im Jahr 1992 noch nicht absehen können, das Holocaust-Mahnmal. So ist der Körper dieser Stadt bleibendes Memento der Schrecken des modernen Krieges. Er stellt in seiner heutigen Verfasstheit zugleich aber die Frage, was wäre, wenn dieser Krieg von alliierter Seite nicht mit aller Konsequenz und Härte ausgefochten worden wäre. Was heißt, moralphilosophisch gesehen, Krieg führen und was heißt es im Hinblick auf Völker, die in einigermaßen freien Wahlen ihrerseits zu Vernichtungskrieg entschlossener Regimes auf den Schild legen. Wir alle wissen, dass diese Frage sich nicht nur stellt im Hinblick auf jene vergangene Zeit, sondern wie auch in unserer eigenen Gegenwart in den Ereignissen der ersten Wochen dieses Jahres wieder bedrängende Aktualität gewonnen hat. Die philosophische Reflexion auf das Phänomen des Kriegs beginnt in unserer Tradition mit Aristoteles. Zeitlich parallel, beziehungsweise schon ein wenig früher, haben wir Narrative mit moralphilosophischem Anspruch über den Krieg in der hebräischen Bibel. Joshua vor Jericho, Judith und Holofernes. Kein großer Denker hat diese Frage gemieden. Augustinus, Thomas von Aquin, Montaigne, Kant und Hegel. Die Geisteswissenschaften im Allgemeinen und die philosophische Reflexion im Speziellen sind aber nicht auf unmittelbare Handlungsanweisung aus. Wir betreiben, auch wenn wir über die Grundfragen der Polis nachdenken, keine wissenschaftliche Politikberatung für unsere Schwesternwissenschaften, die Social Science. Der philosophische Diskurs will das Denken provozieren, im Wortsinn hervorrufen. Ist aus dem Dämmerschlaf, der entsteht aus der Iteration, der Wiederholung der immer gleichen Formen und Konsensen, wachrüttelt. Deshalb muss dieser Diskurs frei sein im empathischen Sinn, er muss auch Kontroverses sagen können, denn er will nicht belehren, sondern die Zuhörer dazu bringen, eigenständig und ihrerseits frei über das nachzudenken, was die Philosophie sagt. Liebe Zuhörer, am gestrigen Abend waren Sie noch in London. Die Stadt versank und versinkt weiterhin im Schnee. Wir alle haben es in den Fernsehnachrichten gesehen. Heathrow war und ist zu. Es war nicht sicher, was heute Abend hier werden wird. Aber dann haben sie die Fluten des Ärmelkanals unterquert, die Weiden der Ile-de-France durchquert und die Landmasse zwischen Paris und Berlin überquert. Sie haben entschlossen, performativ handeln, demonstriert, dass man die scheinbar zwangsläufige Determiniertheit durch das naturhaft Gegebene hier das Wetter nicht akzeptieren muss. Jetzt sind Sie hier, wir freuen uns sehr, seien Sie nochmals sehr herzlich willkommen.
To argue that if we are to make broader social and political claims that all peoples have protection and entitlements to persistence and flourishing, we will first have to be supported by a new bodily ontology, one that implies the rethinking of precariousness, vulnerability, injurability, interdependency, exposure, bodily persistence and desire, work, and the claims of language and social belonging. To refer to ontology in this regard is not to lay claim to a description of fundamental structures of being that are distinct from any and all social and political organization. On the contrary, none of these terms exist outside of their political organization and interpretation. The being of the body to which this ontology refers is one that is always given over to others, to norms, to social and political schemes that seek differentially to maximize precariousness for some and to minimize precariousness for others. It's not possible first to define the ontology of the body and then refer to the social significations that the body assumes. Rather, to be a body is to be exposed to social crafting and form. That is what makes the ontology of the body a social ontology. In other words, the body is exposed to socially and politically articulated forces as well as to claims of sociality, including language, work, and desire, that make possible or thwart the body's persisting and flourishing. The more or less existential conception of precariousness is thus linked with the more politically specific notion of precarity, and it is the differential allocation of precarity that forms, in my view, both the point of departure for rethinking bodily ontology, as well as a point of departure for rethinking progressive or left politics in ways that continue to exceed and traverse the categories of identity. Both of these projects are necessitated, I would suggest, by new wars, by which I mean new ways of administering precariousness. If I am obligated to protect a life, then I must first be able to perceive a life as a life. The epistemological capacity to apprehend a life is partially dependent on that life being produced according to norms that qualify it as a life, or indeed as part of life. In this way, the normative production of ontology thus produces the epistemological problem of apprehending a life. This, in turn, gives rise to the ethical problem of what it is to acknowledge, or indeed to guard, such a life against injury and violence. The frames that work to differentiate lives we can apprehend and those we cannot, or that produce lives across a continuum of life, not only organize visual experience, but establish and generate specific ontologies of the subject. Subjects are constituted through norms that, in their reiteration, produce and shift the terms through which subjects are recognized. These normative conditions for the production of the subject produce an historically contingent ontology, such that our very capacity to discern and name the being of the subject is dependent on norms that facilitate that recognition. At the same time, it would be a mistake to understand the operation of norms as deterministic. Normative schemes are interrupted by one another, emerge and fade, depending on broader operations of power, and very often come up against spectral versions of what it is they claim to know. Thus, there are subjects who are not quite recognizable as subjects, and there are lives that are not quite, or indeed not ever, recognized as lives. In what sense does life then always exceed the normative conditions of its recognizability? To claim that life exceeds those norms is not to say that life has as its essence a resistance to normativity, but only that each and every construction of life requires time to do its job, and that no job it does can overcome time itself. In other words, the job is never done once and for all. This is a limit internal to normative construction itself, a function of its iterability and heterogeneity, without which it cannot exercise its crafting power, and which limits the finality of any of its effects. Let me turn to Hegel for a moment in order to clarify the point I seek to make here about the social ontology of the body. At the outset of Herrschaft und Knechtschaft in the Phenomenology of Spirit, Phenomenologie des Geistes, an other appears, but why and how? How is another possible? How is it possible that this is me over there? And how can I account for this apparent distance between the me over there and the I who regards this me? At first, it seems to be a question of comprehension, but it's hardly a dispassionate moment. I have come outside of myself, it's been out of this gekommen, and I am no longer localized. And this tells me something new about who I am, my relation to space in particular. I am not a fully or exclusively bounded sort of being, since whatever I am, I have the capacity to appear elsewhere. I am a kind of being who is here and there, apparently at once. I can, as it were, face myself, and this involves a certain amount of self-loss. I have become other to myself. It also entails a surprising occurrence of myself at a spatial distance from who I thought I was. I am then not quite bounded in space as I apparently assumed, and this unboundedness by which I am now characterized seems itself to be bound up with a redoubling of myself. The I seems to have become two. Of course, the problem is that the other whom I face is in some sense me, and in some sense not me. So I encounter myself at a spatial distance from myself, redoubled. I encounter at the same time and through the same figure the limit to what I can call myself. Both of these things happen at the same time. But this does not mean that these two encounters are reconciled. On the contrary, they exist in a certain tension with one another. And this other who appears to be me is at once me and not me. So what I have to live with is not just the fact that I have become two, but that I can be found at a distance from myself, and that what I find at that distance is also, and at once, not myself. So it would appear that there is another shape, gestalt, over there, self-subsisting, and that this shape is also an I, and so of the same species, Gattung, as me, co-instantiating a universal form of life. Secondly, it would appear that even as this I is this determinate shape and takes this shape to be the basis of its life is neither this or that life, but the very process of coming into being and dissolving of shape. So to speak of my life is already to refer to to one's own persistent shape, and determinateness is surely part of the picture. But life also refers to non-persistence, to the time when this life did not yet exist, to the alterations that have formed the trajectory of its existence, and to the time in which this life will no longer exist. Not even the this of this life belongs exclusively to me. The fact is, the fact that there is this defining shape over there, characterizing an opposing and similar I, links the sense of my expungibility with my substitutability. It's not only that there's a time before and after I exist, and that this time is part of life, conceived precisely as a differentiating process, but there are others who precede and exceed this I, who survive this life, persist when this life, this I, has not. And even within this life, there are those independent lives that are not the same as my own, which challenge this I to find the truth of itself in its desirous, also then fearful and murderous, relation to others, as a shape, I am bound to others, but also as a shape, I am unbound. Now Hegel, I think, came to establish through these steps the constitutive sociality of self-consciousness. But note how the apprehension of the other as a living being, one whose living is like my own, is essential to this process of developing a social bond. These shapes are considered living, and life, accordingly, is understood as something that belongs to this or that living being. The medium of life, the process of imparting and dissolving shape, has not yet been apprehended when the one self-consciousness understands life to be this or that life. In other words, the shape defines and contains the life. To destroy the shape would be to negate the duplication of shape, and so to eradicate the scandal of substitutability itself. But it will turn out, as we all know, that the living consciousness can only return to its absolute singularity by risking its own life. However, dead, that living consciousness cannot achieve the self-certainty it seeks. So the questions become, how best to live, and how best to live with others. Now, of course, the defensive effort to shore up one's singularity is apparently overwhelming, but it's only by considering singularity and substitutability without a dialectical synthesis that an ethical opening to the other can take place. Who is this I who is, on the one hand, substitutable, and yet also singularly alive on the other? If this I is to register its substitutability, it has to survive as this life to do precisely that. In other words, its singularity is the precondition of its understanding of substitutability, and is presupposed logically by the idea of substitution itself. After all, one singular term is replaced by another singular term. It is in this sense that the non-substitutable is the persistent logical and existential condition of substitutability. As much as the I is threatened by negation or threatens the other with negation, so it is clear that the life of the one is dependent on the life of the other. This interdependency becomes a new way of conceiving of life as sociality. Sociality cannot be reduced to the existence of this or that group. I cannot say, I will survive only to the extent that my group, my nation, will survive. Rather, it is the case that sociality is the open temporal trajectory of interdependency and desire, struggle, fear, murderous dispositions, in a way that links Hegel with Klein, as well as the desire to maintain and repair the social bond. Although I find my departure here in Hegel, indeed in the Hegel that I first read in Germany as a young student, I also move into at least two different directions. The first is to insist on the ethical necessity of a non-coincidence of singularity and substitutability. In other words, the ethical demand to live both singularity, substitutability as an ongoing paradox. Perhaps this brings my position closer to Kierkegaard's or indeed to Levinas. The second is to insist that there can be no recognition of my life being like another's life except through the specific social norms that allow certain populations to emerge as living beings and others to be considered as non-living or as only partially living or as threats to the living. We cannot remain dependent on existing and already established norms of recognition if we are to try and expand our understanding not only of who deserves to live, whose lives are worth protecting, but more fundamentally, whose lives count as lives and whose lives are finally grievable. Perhaps for this purpose, it's necessary to consider how we might distinguish between apprehending and recognizing a life. Recognition is the stronger term, one that's been derived from Hegelian texts and subject to revisions and criticisms for many years. Apprehension is less precise, since it can imply marking, registering, acknowledging without full cognition. If it is a form of knowing, it is bound up with sensing and perceiving, but not always, or not yet, conceptual forms of knowledge. What we are able to apprehend is surely facilitated by norms of recognition, but it would be a mistake to say that we are utterly limited by existing norms of recognition when we apprehend a life. We can apprehend, for instance, that some lives are not recognized by existing norms of recognition. And in that case, apprehension becomes the basis of a critique of existing norms of recognition. The problem is not merely to include more people in existing norms, but to consider how existing norms allocate recognition differentially. What new norms are possible and how are they wrought? What might be done to produce a more egalitarian set of conditions for recognizability? What might be done, in other words, to shift the very terms of recognizability in order to produce more radically democratic results? Now, norms draw upon shifting schemes of intelligibility so that we can and do have, for example, histories of life and histories of death. We have ongoing debates about whether the fetus should count as life, or a human life. We have further debates about conception and what constitutes the first moments of a living organism. We have debates as well about what constitutes death, whether it is the death of the brain, the heart, whether it is the effect of a legal declaration or a set of medical and legal certificates. All of these debates involve contested notions of personhood and implicitly questions regarding the human animal and how that conjunction human-animal, which is also, I think, a chiasm, how that conjunctive existence is to be understood. The fact that these debates exist and continue to exist does not imply that life and death are direct consequences of discourse. Rather, it implies that there is no life and no death without a relation to some discursive frame. Even when life and death take place between, outside, or across the frames by which they are for the most part organized, they still take place, though in ways that call into question the necessity of the mechanisms through which ontological fields are constituted. If a life is produced according to the norms by which life is recognized, This neither implies that everything about the life is produced according to such norms, nor that we must reject the idea that there is a remainder of life, suspended and spectral, that limns and haunts every normative instance of life. Production is partial and is indeed perpetually haunted by its ontologically uncertain double. Indeed, every normative instance is shadowed by its own failure, and very often that failure assumes a figural form. So normative life is haunted by the figure of failed life, or of a life that is not quite a life. The figure lays claim to no certain ontological status, and though it can be apprehended as living, it's not always recognized as life. In fact, a living figure outside the bounds of life not only becomes the problem to be managed by normativity, but it seems to be that which normativity is bound to reproduce. It is living, but not alive. It falls outside the frame, furnished by the norm, but only as a relentless double whose ontology cannot be secured, but whose living status is open to apprehension. As we know, to be framed is a complex phrase in English. A picture is framed, but so too is a criminal by the police, or an innocent person by someone nefarious, often again the police. So that to be framed is to be set up or to have evidence planted against a person that ultimately proves that person's guilt. When a picture is framed, any number of ways of commenting on or extending the picture may be at stake. But the frame tends to function, even in a minimalist form, as an editorial embellishment of the image, if not a self-commentary on the history of the frame itself. This sense that the frame implicitly guides the interpretation has some resonance with the idea of the frame as a false accusation. If one is framed, then a frame is constructed around one's deed, such that one's guilty status becomes the viewer's inevitable conclusion. Some way of organizing and presenting a deed leads to an interpretive conclusion about the deed itself. But as we know from Trin Minh Ha, it is possible to frame the frame, or indeed the framer, which involves exposing the ruse that produces the effect of individual guilt. To frame the frame seems to involve a certain highly reflexive overlay of the visual field, but in my view, this does not have to result in rarefied forms of reflexivity. On the contrary, to call the frame into question is to show that the frame never quite contained the scene it was meant to limn, that something was already outside, which made the very sense of the inside possible, recognizable. The frame never quite determines precisely what it is we see, think, recognize, and apprehend. Something exceeds the frame that troubles our sense of reality. In other words, something occurs that does not conform to our established understanding of things. A certain leakage or contamination makes this process more fallible than it might at first appear. Walter Benjamin's argument about the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction can be adapted for understanding the means through which recognition is produced. The technical conditions of reproduction and reproducibility themselves produce a critical shifting, if not a full deterioration of context, in relation to the frames deployed by both state and dominant media sources during times of war. This means, in the first instance, that even if one could, in considering global media coverage, delimit a single context for the creation of war photography, its circulation would necessarily depart from such a context. Although the image surely lands in new contexts, it also creates new contexts by virtue of that arrival, becoming a part of the very process through which new contexts are delimited and formed. In other words, the circulation of war photos, war images, as with the dissemination of prison poetry, breaks with context all the time. In effect, the poetry written in Guantanamo left the Guantanamo prison, as did the digital images of torture in Abu Ghraib. The photos circulated on the internet, even when they were not intended for that purpose. The photos, as well as the poetry, failed to circulate because some of them were destroyed or because they were never permitted to leave the prison cell. These are incendiary as much for what they depict as for the limitations imposed on their circulation. This very circulability is part of what is destroyed when censorship takes place. And if that fact, the fact of censorship, then leaks out, the report on that destructive act circulates in place of what is destroyed. What gets out of hand is precisely what breaks from the context that frames the event, the image, the text of war. But if contexts are framed, and there is no context without an explicit delimitation of context, and if a frame invariably breaks from itself as it moves through space and time, indeed must break from itself in order to move across space and time, then the circulating frame has to break with the context in which it is formed if it is to land or arrive somewhere else, if it is to become efficacious. What would it mean to understand this breaking out and breaking from as part of the media phenomena at issue, as the very function of the frame? The frame that seeks to contain, convey, and determine what is seen, and sometimes succeeds in doing precisely that for a stretch, depends upon the conditions of reproducibility in order to succeed. And yet, this very reproducibility entails a constant breaking from context, a constant delimitation of new context, which means that the frame does not quite contain what it conveys. Rather, the frame breaks apart every time it seeks to give definitive organization to its content. The frame doesn't hold anything together in one place. It becomes a kind of perpetual breakage, subject to the temporal logic by which it moves from place to place. So as the frame constantly breaks from its context, this self-breaking becomes part of its very definition. This leads us to a different way of understanding both the frame's efficacy and its vulnerability to reversal, to subversion, even to critical instrumentalization. What is taken for granted in one instance becomes thematized critically or even incredulously in another. This shifting temporal dimension of the frame constitutes the possibility and trajectory of its affect as well. The digital image thus circulated outside the confines of Abu Ghraib, and the poetry in Guantanamo recovered by constitutional lawyers who arranged for its publication and dissemination throughout the world. The conditions are set for astonishment, outrage, revulsion, admiration, and discovery, depending on the way the content is framed by shifting time and place. The movement of the image or the text outside of confinement is a kind of breaking out, so that even though neither the image nor the poetry can free anyone from forced confinement, or literally stop a bomb, or indeed reverse the course of the war, they nevertheless do provide the conditions for breaking out of the quotidian acceptance of war and for a more generalized horror and outrage that support and impel calls for justice and the end to violence. Earlier I noted that one sense of to be framed means to be subject to a con, to a tactic by which evidence is orchestrated to make a false accusation appear true. Some power manipulates the terms of appearance, and one cannot break out of the frame. One is framed, which means one is accused, but also judged in advance, without valid evidence, and without any obvious recourse to redress. But if the frame is understood as a certain breaking out or breaking from, then it would seem to be more analogous to a prison break. This suggests a certain release, a loosening of the mechanism of control, and with it, a new trajectory of affect. The frame permits for, even requires, this breaking out. This happened when the photos of Guantanamo prisoners kneeling and shackled were released to the public, and outrage ensued. It happened again when the digital images from Abu Ghraib were circulated globally across the internet, facilitating a widespread visceral turn against the war. What happens at such moments? And are they merely transient moments? Or are they in fact occasions when the frame, as a forcible and plausible con, is exposed, resulting in a critical and exuberant release from the force of illegitimate authority? The production of new frames, of counterframes, or the interruption and disturbance of existing frames as part of the general project of alternative media is clearly important. We would miss a critical dimension of this project, however, if we restricted our understanding to this view. What happens when a frame breaks with itself is that a taken-for-granted reality is called into question, exposing the orchestrating designs of the authority who sought to control the frame. This suggests that it's not only a question of finding new content, but of working with received renditions of reality to show how they can and do break with themselves. In other words, the task is to find and exploit the fissure within an accepted ontological field. As a consequence, the frames that decide which lives will be recognizable as lives and which will not must circulate in order to establish their hegemony. This circulation brings out, or rather is, the iterable structure of the frame. As frames break from themselves in order to install themselves, some other possibilities for apprehension emerge. When those frames which govern the relative and differential recognizability of lives come apart as part of the very mechanism of their circulation, then so too does it become possible to apprehend something about what and who is living but has not been generally recognized as alive. What is this specter that gnaws at the norms of recognition? An intensified figure vacillating as its outside and its inside. As inside, it must be expelled to purify the norm. As outside, it threatens to undo the boundaries that limb or boundary the self. In either case, it figures the collapsibility of the norm. In other words, it is a sign that the norm functions precisely by way of managing the prospect of its undoing, an undoing that inheres in its doings. We read about lives lost. We're often given the numbers of lives lost, but these stories repeat every day, and the repetition appears endless, even irremediable. One could say, for instance, that the number of lives lost in Gaza has been counted. Indeed, several human rights organizations have suggested that it's close to 1,400 Palestinians who were killed in that war, and less than 15 Israelis who were killed in that war. That's not counting the injured or the homeless. One could say that we have those numbers, but how does numerical recognition work? Does that numerical recognition establish that such lives really count? And so we have to ask, what would it take not only to apprehend the precarious character of lives lost in war, but to have that apprehension coincide with an ethical and political opposition to the losses induced by war? Among the questions that follow from this situation are, how is affect produced by the structure of the numerical frame, and what is its relation to ethical and political judgment and practice? To say that a life is precarious requires not only that a life be apprehended as a life, but also that precariousness be an aspect of what is apprehended in what is living. Normatively construed, I am arguing that there ought to be a more inclusive and egalitarian way of recognizing precariousness, and that this should take form as concrete social policy regarding such issues as shelter, work, food, medical care, and legal status. And yet I'm also insisting, in a way that may seem initially paradoxical, that precariousness itself cannot be properly recognized. It can be apprehended, taken in, encountered. It can be presupposed by certain norms of recognition, just as it can be refused by certain norms of recognition. Indeed, there ought to be a recognition of precariousness as a shared condition of human life, indeed, as a condition that links human and non-human animals. But we ought not to think that the recognition of precariousness masters or captures or even fully cognizes what it recognizes. So though I would and do argue that norms of recognition ought to be based on an apprehension of precariousness, I do not think that precariousness is a function or an effect of recognition. And I do not think that recognition is the only or best way to come to register precariousness. To say, for instance, that a life is injurable, that it can be lost, destroyed, or systematically neglected to the point of death, is to underscore not only the finitude of a life, that death is certain, an existential truth, but the precariousness of a life, that life requires various social and economic conditions to be met repeatedly in order to be sustained as a life. Precariousness implies living socially, that is, the fact that one's own life is always, in some sense, in the hands of the other. It implies exposure to those we both know and do not know, dependency on those we know, barely know, or know not at all. Reciprocally, it implies being impinged upon by the exposure and dependency of others, most of whom remain anonymous. These are not necessarily relations of love or even of care, but they do constitute obligations towards those, most of whom we cannot name, do not know, and who may or may not bear traits of familiarity to an established sense of who we are, whoever we is. In the interest of speaking in common parlance, we could say that we have such obligations to others and presume that we know who we are at such an instance. The social implication of this view, however, is precisely that the we does not, cannot recognize itself, that it is riven from start, interrupted by alterity, not structured by similitude, and that the obligations we have are precisely toward those that disrupt any established notion of the we. Right? So there are those who say that we have to have a common we in order to move towards common obligations. I think it is precisely the non-commonality of the we that must be the basis of our obligations. Over and against an existential concept of finitude that makes radically singular our relation to death and to life, precariousness underscores our radical substitutability and anonymity in relation to certain socially facilitated modes of dying and death, and socially conditioned modes of persisting and flourishing. It's not that we're born and then later become precarious. Precariousness is coextensive with the birth of the infant, which is, after all, a social event dependent on institutional structures. Which means that it matters whether or not this being survives, and its survival is dependent on what we might call a social network of cans. Precisely because a living being may die, it is necessary to care for that being so that it may live. Only under conditions in which the loss would matter does the value of the life appear. Thus, grievability is a presupposition for the life that matters. For the most part, we imagine that an infant comes into the world, is sustained in and by that world, hopefully, and finally dies. We imagine that when the child is wanted, there is celebration at the beginning of life. But there can be no celebration without an implicit understanding that this life is grievable. In other words, that if this life were to be lost, it would be a loss and it would be marked as a loss. This future anterior is installed as the condition of the infant's life. The future anterior, a life has been lived, is presupposed not at the end of life, but at the beginning of life, a life that has only begun to be lived. In other words, this will be a life that will have lived and whose loss will be mourned in the future. This is the presupposition of a grievable life. This will be a life that can be regarded as a life and sustained by that regard. This is a life which, if lost, will be grieved. Is a statement that structures the very living of that life. Without grievability, there is no life, or rather, there is something living that is other than life. Instead, there is a life that will never have been lived, sustained by no regard, no testimony, and ungrieved when lost. The apprehension of grievability precedes and makes possible the apprehension of precarious life. Grievability precedes and makes possible the apprehension of the living being as living, exposed to non-life from the start. One could object and say, that the ideal of livable life could give ground to those who want to distinguish between lives worth living and lives worth destroying, precisely the rationale that supports certain kinds of war efforts that distinguish between valuable and grievable lives on the one hand and devalued and ungrievable lives on the other. But such a conclusion neglects the important qualification that egalitarian standards impose on the consideration of what is a livable life. Precariousness has to be grasped not simply as a feature of this or that life, but as a generalized condition whose very generality can be denied only by denying precariousness itself. The injunction to think precariousness in terms of equality emerges precisely from the irrefutable generalizability of this condition. On this basis, one must object to the differential allocation of precariousness and grievability. The very idea of precariousness implies dependency on social networks and conditions, suggesting that there is no life itself at issue here, but always and only conditions of life. Life as something that requires conditions in order to become livable life, and indeed in order to become grievable. So the conclusion is not that everything that can die or is subject to destruction, that is, all life processes, imposes an obligation to preserve life. But an obligation does emerge from the fact that we are, as it were, social beings from the start, dependent on what is outside ourselves, on others, on institutions, and sustained and sustainable environments, and in this sense, precarious. To sustain life as sustainable requires putting those conditions in place and militating for their renewal and strengthening. Where a life stands no chance of flourishing, there one must attend to ameliorating the negative conditions of life. Precarious life implies life as a conditioned process, not the internal feature of a monastic individual or any other anthropocentric conceit. Certainly not to a drive. Our obligations are precisely to those conditions that make life possible, not to life itself. Our obligations emerge from the insight that there can be no sustained life without sustaining conditions, and those conditions are our political responsibility and the matter of our most vexed ethical decisions. In recent months, in Israel as in the United States, ongoing wars have tended to produce iconic versions of populations who are eminently grievable, and others whose loss is no loss and remain ungrievable. The differential distribution of grievability across populations has implications for why and when we feel politically consequential affective dispositions, such as horror, guilt, righteous sadism, loss, and indifference. Why, in particular, has there been within the U.S. a righteous response to certain forms of violence inflicted on civilian populations by the U.S. military, and yet incursions suffered by our own civilians are either loudly mourned, considered unthinkable and inassimilable, because radically unacceptable? If we take the precariousness of life as a point of departure, then there's no life without the need for shelter and food, no life without dependency on wider networks of sociology and labor, no life that transcends endurability and mortality. We might then analyze tributaries of military power in Israel during the recent assault on Gaza and the ongoing siege as attempting to maximize precariousness for Palestinians while minimizing precariousness for Israelis. This is, of course, a strategy that cannot work, precisely because it seeks to deny, on the Israeli part, one's own precariousness by establishing the other as radically precarious. The generalized condition is denied in favor of a differential distribution of precarity. One might say that this cannot work, assault, siege, since to deny the other's precariousness, in other words, there's a maximizing of precariousness within Gaza at the same time that there's a denial that that precariousness imposes any obligations on those who are assaulting. Now one could say this is just bad thinking, it's strategically unwise. The other, the Palestinian, will seek to deny one's own precariousness in turn, in other words, deny any obligation that Israelis may have on Palestinians to have their lives also sheltered or protected. But my argument is not exactly a strategic or a consequentialist one. The denial of one's own precariousness seeks to deny the social ontology in which we are each exposed to the other, and where precariousness is a generalized condition of social ontology. Ultimately, I want to argue that this way of being bound to one another in precariousness is not a social bond that is entered into contractually. It is to the stranger we are bound, the one we never knew and never chose. To kill the other is to deny my life, not just mine alone, but that sense of my life which is, from the start, an invariably social life. So, my return to Hegel. This generalized truth is manifest in some explicit ways in the relation between Israel, what is called Israel, and Palestine, since they are joined inextricably, without contract, without reciprocal agreement, and yet ineluctably. And so the question emerges, what obligations are to be derived from this dependency, this contiguity and proximity that now defines each population, which exposes each to the fear of destruction and which incites destructiveness? How are we to understand such bonds, which are also the bonds without which neither population can live and survive, and to what obligations do they lead? It is one thing to think that one must destroy the other in order to survive. My survival is at stake, so I must destroy the other who appears to attack me or to want my destruction. But it is quite another to see that I have been misnaming survival from the start. In other words, what is most important is to see that survival depends upon being able to live and sustain that relation, since it is only in the context of our interdependency and our proximity that any of us stand a chance of surviving. With this perspective, then, on precariousness, I wish to make a kind of modest suggestion that politics on the left might consider precariousness or precarity as an existing and promising site for a certain kind of coalitional exchange. This framework must give us a way to militate against the mobilization of progressive domestic agendas, feminism or sexual freedom, for war and anti-immigration politics, even for rationales for sexual torture. It would mean thinking sexual politics together with immigration politics in new ways. It would involve considering how populations are exposed to conditions that jeopardize the possibility of persisting and flourishing. For populations to become grievable in the way that I suggested does not require that we come to know the singularity of every person who is at risk or who has indeed already been risked or destroyed. It means that policy needs to understand precariousness as a shared condition, and precarity as the politically induced condition that seeks to deny equal exposure through the radically unequal distribution of wealth and the differential ways of exposing certain populations, racially and nationally conceptualized, to greater violence. The recognition of shared precariousness introduces strong normative commitments of equality and spurs the movement to further a more robust universalizing of rights that seeks to address basic human needs, human animal needs, for food, shelter, and other conditions for persisting and flourishing. We might be tempted to call these material needs, and they surely are that. But once we acknowledge that the frames through which such needs are affirmed or denied make possible the practices of war, we have to conclude that the frames of war are part of what makes the materiality of war. Just as the matter of bodies cannot appear without a shaping and animating form, neither can the matter of war appear without a conditioned and facilitating form or frame. The operation of cameras, not only in the recording and distribution of images of torture, but as part of their very apparatus of bombing, make clear that media representations have already become modes of military conduct. So there's no way to separate, under present historical conditions, the material reality of war from those representational regimes through which it operates and which rationalize its own operation. The perceptual realities produced through such frames do not precisely lead to war policy, and neither do such policies unilaterally create frames of perception. Perception and policy are but two modalities of the same process whereby the ontological status of a targeted population is compromised and suspended. This is not the same as bare life, since the lines in question are not cast outside the polis in a state of radical exposure. They are rather bound and constrained by power relations in a situation of forcible exposure. It's not the withdrawal or absence of law that is the problem of precariousness, but the very effects of illegitimate legal coercion itself, or the power of the state that has freed itself from the constraints of law only to remobilize law in the service of its power. Finally, then, these reflections have implications for thinking through the body as well, since there are no conditions that can fully solve the problem of human precariousness. Bodies come into being and cease to be. As physically persistent organisms, they are subject to incursions, to illness, that jeopardize the possibility of persisting at all. These are necessary features of bodies. They cannot be thought without their finitude, and they depend on what is outside themselves to be sustained. To live is always to live a life that is at risk from the outset and can be put at risk or expunged quite suddenly from the outside and for reasons that are not always under one's control. The shared condition of precariousness implies that the body is constitutively social and interdependent, a view clearly confirmed in different ways by Hobbes and by Hegel. Yet precisely because each body finds itself potentially threatened by others who are, by definition, precarious as well, forms of domination follow. This standard Hegelian point takes on specific meanings under contemporary conditions of war. The shared condition of precariousness leads not to reciprocal recognition, but to a specific exploitation of targeted populations, lives that are not quite lives, cast as destructible and as ungrievable. Such populations are losable, they can be forfeited, precisely because they are framed as already lost and already dead. They are sometimes cast as threats to human life as we know it, rather than as living populations in need of protection from illegitimate state violence, famine, or pandemics. They are societies that are sometimes cast as human shields. We saw recently the discussion of children in Gaza and also in southern Lebanon, at which point they become not living human beings, but arsenals of war. So when such lives are lost, they are not grievable, since in the twisted logic that rationalizes their death, the loss of such populations is deemed necessary to protect the lives of the living. So this would be a population that figures the threat to life and so must be killed in the name of life. If those lives are dispensable, then we have misunderstood who we are, miscalculated the heightened risks to which we subject the plural we by becoming destructive of other life. And here I do not refer to the kinds of persons we are, morally or nationally, but only to the kind of breathing and thinking animals we are, as well as the networks of overlapping life we live, if any of us are to live at all. Those networks are not bound by nation or topography, and certainly not by race, since we are dependent on those we do not know and never chose in order to live at all. And they also depend on us in our anonymity, substitutability, and vigilance as we militate against destruction. Perhaps the task is to learn to live with those we have never known and never chosen, and to understand what obligations emerge from us from the region of necessary and inextricable ties. Thank you.
Bescheiden ausfallen. Danke für Ihr Kommen.